married couple to express their feelings by yelling at each other. On the frequent occasions when he upset her by working late, leaving her to sit alone and eat the dinner she had fixed for him, a certain coolness was the closest they came to fighting. But this was worse than missing supper. He was abandoning her and the baby just when they needed him. They had a long talk that evening. At the end of it, Angela was no happier, but she was at least resigned. He had called her several times since, from London and from Tehran. She was watching the riots on the TV news and worrying about him. She would have been even more worried if she had known what he was about to do now.
He pushed domestic concerns to the back of his mind and went to find Abul Hassan. Abul Hassan was EDS's senior Iranian employee. When Lloyd Briggs had left for New York, Abul Hassan had been in charge of EDS in Iran. Rich Gallagher, the only American still there, was not a manager. Then Keen Taylor had returned and assumed overall charge, and Abul Hassan had been offended. Taylor was no diplomat. Bill Gayden, the genial president of EDS World, had coined the sarcastic phrase, Keen's Marine Corps sensitivity training. There had been friction. But Hal got on fine with Abul Hassan, who could translate not just the Farsi language, but also Persian customs and methods for his American employers. Dagar knew Abul Hassan's father, a distinguished lawyer, and had met Abul Hassan himself at the interrogation of Paul and Bill. So this morning, Abul Hassan had been appointed liaison man with Dadgar's investigators and had been instructed to make sure they had everything they asked for. Howell said to Abul Hassan, I've decided I should meet with Dadgar. What do you think?
Sure,
Abul Hassan said. He had an American wife and spoke English with an American accent. I don't think there'll be a problem. Okay, let's go. Abul Hassan led Howell to Paul Schiaparoni's conference room. Dadgar and his assistants were sitting around the big table, going through EDS's financial records. Abul Hassan asked Dadgar to step into the adjoining room, Paul's office. Then he introduced Howell. Dadgar gave a businesslike handshake. They sat around the table in the corner of the office. Dadgar did not look to Howell like a monster, just a rather weary middle-aged man who was losing his hair. Howell began by repeating to Dadgar what he had said to Dr. Kian. EDS is a reputable company that has done nothing wrong, and we are willing to cooperate with your investigation. However, we cannot tolerate having two senior executives in jail. Dadgar's answer, translated by Abul Hassan, surprised him. If you have done nothing wrong, why have you not paid the bail? There's no connection between the two, Howell said. Bail is a guarantee that someone will appear for trial, not a sum to be forfeited if he's guilty. Bail is repaid as soon as the accused man appears in court, regardless of the verdict. While Abul Hassan translated, Howell wondered whether bail was the correct English translation of whatever Farsi word Dadgar was using to describe the $12,750,000 he was demanding. And now Howell recalled something else that might be significant. On the day Paul and Bill were arrested, he had talked on the phone with Abul Hassan, who reported that the $12,750,000 was, according to Dadgar, the total amount EDS had been paid to date by the Ministry of Health. And Dadgar's argument had been that if the contract had been corruptly awarded, then EDS was not entitled to that money. Abul Hassan had not translated this remark to Paul and Bill at the time. In fact, EDS had been paid a good deal more than $13 million, so the remark had not made much sense, and Howell had discounted it. Perhaps that had been a mistake. It might just be that Dadgar's arithmetic was wrong. Abul Hassan was translating Dadgar's reply. If the men are innocent, there is no reason why they should not appear for trial, so you would risk nothing by paying the bail. An American corporation can't do that, Howell said. He was not lying, but he was being deliberately deceitful. EDS is a publicly traded company, and under American securities laws, it can only use its money for the benefit of its shareholders. Paul and Bill are free individuals. The company cannot guarantee that they will show up for trial. Consequently, we cannot spend the company's money this way. This was the initial negotiating position Howell had previously formulated. But as Abul Hassan translated, he could see it was making little impression on Dadgar. Their families have to put up the bail, he went on. Right now they are raising money in the States, but $13 million is out of the question. Now, if the bail were lowered to a more reasonable figure, they might be able to pay it. This was all lies, of course. Ross Perot was going to pay the bail, if he had to, and if Tom Walter could find a way to get the money into Iran. It was Dadgar's turn to be surprised. Is it true that you could not force your men to appear for trial? Sure it's true, Howell said. What are we going to do, lock them in chains? We're not a police force. You see, you're holding individuals in jail for alleged crimes of a corporation. Dadgar's reply was, No, they are in jail for what they have done personally, which is, they obtained money from the Ministry of Health by means of false progress reports. This obviously cannot apply to Bill Gaylord because the Ministry has paid none of the bills presented since he arrived in Tehran. So what is he accused of? He falsified reports, and I will not be cross-examined by you, Mr. Howell. Howell suddenly remembered that Dadgar could put him in jail. Dadgar went on, I am conducting an investigation. But it is complete. I will either release your clients or prosecute them. Howell said, We're willing to cooperate with your investigation. In the meantime, what can we do to get Paul and Bill released? Pay the bail. And if they are released on bail, will they be permitted to leave Iran? No.
Jay Coburn walked through the double sliding glass doors into the lobby of the Sheraton. On his right was the long registration desk. To his left were the hotel shops. In the center of the lobby was a couch. In accordance with his instructions, he bought a copy of Newsweek magazine at the newsstand. He sat on the couch, facing the doors so that he could see everyone who came in, and pretended to read the magazine. He felt like a character in a spy movie. The rescue plan was in a holding pattern while Majid researched the colonel in charge of the jail. Meanwhile, Coburn was doing a job for Perot. He had an assignation with a man nicknamed Deep Throat, after the secretive character who gave deep background to reporter Bob Woodward in All the President's Men. This Deep Throat was an American management consultant who gave seminars to foreign corporate executives on how to do business with the Iranians. Before Paul and Bill were arrested, Lloyd Briggs had engaged Deep Throat to help EDS get the ministry to pay its bills. He had advised Briggs that EDS was in bad trouble, but for a payment of $2.5 million, they could get the slate wiped clean. At the time, EDS had scorned this advice. The government owed money to EDS, not vice versa. It was the Iranians who needed to get the slate wiped clean. The arrest had given credibility to Deep Throat, as it had to Bunny Fleischacker, and Briggs had contacted him again. Well, they're mad at you now, he had said. It's going to be harder than ever, but I'll see what I can do. He had called back yesterday. He could solve the problem, he said. He demanded a face-to-face meeting with Ross Perot. Taylor, Howell, Young, and Gallagher all agreed there was no way Perot was going to expose himself to such a meeting. They were horrified that Deep Throat even knew Perot was in town. So Perot asked Simons if he could send Coburn instead, and Simons consented. Coburn had called Deep Throat and said he would be representing Perot. No, no, said Deep Throat. It has to be Perot himself. Then all deals are off, Coburn had replied. Okay, okay. Deep Throat had backed down and given Coburn instructions. Coburn had to go to a certain phone booth in the Vanak area, not far from Keen Taylor's house, at 8 p.m. At exactly 8 o'clock, the phone in the booth rang. Deep Throat told Coburn to go to the Sheraton, which was nearby, and sit in the lobby reading Newsweek. They would meet there and identify one another by a code. Deep Throat would say, Do you know where Pahlavi Avenue is? It was a block away, but Coburn was to reply, No, I don't. I'm new in town. That was why he felt like he was in a spy movie. On Simon's advice, he was wearing his long, bulky down coat, the one Taylor called his Michelin Man coat. The object was to find out whether Deep Throat would frisk him. If not, he would be able, at any future meetings, to wear a recording device under the coat and tape the conversation. He flicked through the pages of Newsweek. Do you know where Pahlavi Avenue is? Coburn looked up to see a man of his own height and weight, in his early 40s, with dark, slicked down hair and glasses. No, I don't. I'm new in town. Deep Throat looked around nervously. Let's go, he said. Over there. Coburn got up and followed him to the back of the hotel. They stopped in a dark passage. I'll have to frisk you, said Deep Throat. Coburn raised his arms. What are you afraid of? Deep Throat gave a scornful laugh. You can't trust anyone. There are no rules anymore in this town. He finished his search. Do we go back to the lobby now? No. I could be under surveillance. I can't risk being seen with you. Okay. What are you offering? Deep Throat gave the same scornful laugh. You guys are in trouble, he said. You've already messed up once by refusing to listen to people who know this country. How did we mess up? You think this is Texas. It's not. But how did we mess up? You could have got out of this for $2.5 million. Now it'll cost you six. What's the deal? Just a minute. You let me down last time. This is going to be your last chance. This time there's no backing out at the last minute. Coburn was beginning to dislike Deep Throat. The man was a wise guy. His whole manner said, You're such fools, and I know so much more than you, it's hard for me to descend to your level. Whom do we pay the money to? Coburn asked. A numbered account in Switzerland. And how do we know we'll get what we're paying for? Deep Throat laughed. Listen, the way things work in this country, you don't let go of your money until the goods are delivered. That's the way to get things done here. Okay, so what's the arrangement? Lloyd Briggs meets me in Switzerland, and we open an escrow account and sign a letter of agreement that is lodged with the bank. The money is released from the account when Chaperoni and Gaylord get out, which will be immediately, if you'll just let me handle this. Who gets the money? Deep Throat just shook his head contemptuously. Coburn said, Well, how do we know you really have a deal wired? Look, I'm just passing on information from people close to the person who's causing you a problem. You mean Dadgar? You'll never learn, will you? As well as finding out what Deep Throat's proposal was, Coburn had to make a personal evaluation of the man. Well, he had made it now. Deep Throat was full of shit. Okay, Coburn said. We'll be in touch. Keen Taylor poured a little rum into a big glass, added ice, and filled the glass with coke. This was his regular drink. Taylor was a big man, 6'2", 210 pounds, with a chest like a barrel. He had played football in the Marines. He took care with his clothes, favoring suits with deep plunging vests and shirts with button-down collars. He wore large gold-rimmed glasses. He was 39 and losing his hair. The young Taylor had been a hellraiser, a dropout from college, busted down from sergeant in the Marines for disciplinary offenses, and he still disliked close supervision. He preferred working in the world subsidiary of EDS because the head office was so far away. He was under close supervision now. After 4 days in Tehran, Ross Perot was savage. Taylor dreaded the evening debriefing sessions with his boss. After he and Howell had spent the day dashing around the city, fighting the traffic, the demonstrations, and the intransigence of Iranian officialdom, they would have to explain to Perot why they had achieved precisely nothing. To make matters worse, Perot was confined to the hotel most of the time. He had gone out only twice, once to the U.S. Embassy and once to U.S. military headquarters. Taylor had made sure no one offered him the keys to a car or any local currency to discourage any impulse Perot might have had to take a walk. But the result was that Perot was like a caged bear, and being debriefed by him was like getting into the cage with the bear. At least Taylor no longer had to pretend that he did not know about the rescue team. Coburn had taken him to meet Simons, and they had talked for 3 hours, or rather, Taylor had talked. Simons just asked questions. They had sat in the living room of Taylor's house, with Simons dropping cigar ash on Taylor's carpet, and Taylor had told him that Iran was like an animal with its head cut off. The head, the ministers and officials, were still trying to give orders, but the body, the Iranian people, were off doing their own thing. Consequently, political pressure would not free Paul and Bill. They would have to be bailed out or rescued. For 3 hours, Simons had never changed the tone of his voice, never offered an opinion, never even moved from the chair. But the Simons ice was easier to deal with than the Perot fire. Each morning, Perot would knock on the door while Taylor was shaving. Taylor got up a little earlier each day in order to be ready when Perot came. But Perot got up earlier each day, too, until Taylor began to fantasize that Perot listened outside the door all night, waiting to catch him shaving. Perot would be full of ideas that had come to him during the night, new arguments for Paul and Bill's innocence, new schemes for persuading the Iranians to release them. Taylor and John Howell, the tall and the short, like Batman and Robin, would head off in the Batmobile to the Ministry of Justice or the Ministry of Health, where officials would demolish Perot's ideas in seconds. Perot was still using a legalistic, rational American approach, and in Taylor's opinion, had yet to realize that the Iranians were not playing according to those rules. This was not all Taylor had on his mind. His wife, Mary, and the children, Mike and Dawn, were staying with his parents in Pittsburgh. Taylor's mother and father were both over 80, both in failing health. His mother had a heart condition. Mary was having to deal with that on her own. She had not complained, but he could tell when he talked to her on the phone that she was not happy. Taylor sighed. He could not cope with all the world's problems at one time. He topped up his drink, then, carrying the glass, left his room and went to Perot's suite for the evening bloodbath.
Perot paced up and down the sitting room of the suite, waiting for the negotiating team to gather. He was doing no good here in Tehran, and he knew it. He had suffered a chilly reception at the U.S. Embassy. He had been shown into the office of Charles Ness, the ambassador's deputy. Ness had been gracious, but had given Perot the same old story about how EDS should work through the legal system for the release of Paul and Bill. Perot had insisted on seeing the ambassador. He had come halfway around the world to see Sullivan, and he was not going to leave before speaking to him. Eventually, Sullivan came in, shook Perot's hand, and told him he was most unwise to come to Iran. It was clear that Perot was a problem, and Sullivan did not want any more problems. He talked for a while, but did not sit down, and he left as soon as he could. Perot was not used to such treatment. He was, after all, an important American, and in normal circumstances, a diplomat such as Sullivan would be at least courteous, if not deferential. Perot also met Lou Gulse, who seemed sincerely concerned about Paul and Bill, but offered no concrete help. Outside Nas's office, he ran into a group of military attachés who recognized him. Since the prisoners of war campaign, Perot had always been able to count on a warm reception from the American military. He sat down with the attachés and told them his problem. They said candidly that they could not help. "Look, forget what you read in the paper. Forget what the State Department is saying publicly," one of them told him. "We don't have any power here. We don't have any control. You're wasting your time in the U.S. Embassy." Perot had also wasted his time at U.S. military headquarters. Kathy Gallagher's boss, Colonel Keith Barlow, chief of the U.S. Support Activity Command in Iran, had sent a bulletproof car to the Hyatt. Perot had got in with Rich Gallagher. The driver had been Iranian. Perot wondered which side he was on. They met with Air Force General Philip Gast, chief of the U.S. Military Assistance Advisory Group, MAAG, in Iran, and General Dutch Heuser. Perot knew Heuser slightly and remembered him as a strong, dynamic man, but now he looked drained. Perot knew from the newspapers that Heuser was President Carter's emissary, here to persuade the Iranian military to back the doomed Bakhtiar government. And Perot guessed that Heuser had no stomach for the job. Heuser candidly said he would like to help Paul and Bill, but at the moment he had no leverage with the Iranians. He had nothing to trade. Even if they got out of jail, Heuser said, they would be in danger here. Perot told them he had taken care of that. Bull Simons was here to look after Paul and Bill once they got out. Heuser burst out laughing, and a moment later Gass saw the joke. They knew who Simons was, and they knew he would be planning more than a babysitting job. Gast offered to supply fuel to Simons, but that was all. Warm words from the military, cold words from the embassy. Little or no real help from either. And nothing but excuses from Howell and Taylor. Sitting in a hotel room all day was driving Perot crazy. Today, Kathy Gallagher had asked him to take care of her poodle, Buffy. She made it sound like an honor, a measure of her high esteem for Perot, and he had been so surprised that he had agreed. Sitting looking at the animal, he had realized that this was a funny occupation for the leader of a major international business, and he wondered how the hell he'd let himself be talked into it. He got no sympathy from Keen Taylor, who thought it was funny as hell. After a few hours, Kathy had come back from the hairdresser's, or wherever she had been, and had taken the dog back. But Perot's mood remained black. There was a knock at Perot's door, and Taylor came in, carrying his usual drink. He was followed by John Howell, Rich Gallagher, and Bob Young. They all sat down. "Now," said Perot, "did you tell them that we'd guarantee to produce Paul and Bill for questioning anywhere in the U.S. or Europe on 30 days' notice at any time in the next 2 years?" "They're not interested in that idea," said Howell. "What do you mean they're not interested?" "I'm just telling you what they said." "But if this is an investigation, rather than a blackmail attempt, all they need is to be sure that Paul and Bill will be available for questioning." "They're sure already. I guess they see no reason to make changes." It was maddening. There seemed no way to reason with the Iranians, no way to reach them. "Did you suggest they release Paul and Bill into the custody of the U.S. Embassy?" "They turned that down, too." "Why?" "They didn't say." "Did you ask them?" "Ross, they don't have to give reasons. They're in charge here, and they know it." "But they're responsible for the safety of their prisoners." "It's a responsibility that doesn't seem to weigh too heavily on them," Taylor said. "Ross, they're not playing by our rules. Putting two men in jail is not a big deal to them. Paul and Bill's safety is not a big deal." "So what rules are they playing by? Can you tell me that?" There was a knock at the door, and Coburn walked in, wearing his Michelin Man coat and his black knit hat. Perot brightened. Perhaps he would have good news. "Did you meet with Deep Throat?" "Sure did," said Coburn, taking off his coat. "All right, let's have it. He says he can get Paul and Bill released for $6 million. The money would be paid into an escrow account in Switzerland, and released when Paul and Bill leave Iran." "Hell, that ain't bad," said Perot. "We get out with 50 cents on the dollar. Under U.S. law, it would even be legal. It's a ransom." "What kind of guy is Deep Throat?" "I don't trust the bastard," said Coburn. "Why?" Coburn shrugged. "I don't know, Ross. He's shifty, flaky. A bullshitter. I wouldn't give him 60 cents to go to the store and get me a pack of cigarettes. That's my gut feeling." "But listen, what do you expect?" Perot said. "This is bribery. Pillars of the community don't get involved in this kind of thing." Howell said, "You said it. This is bribery." His deliberate, throaty voice was unusually passionate. "I don't like this one bit." "I don't like it," Perot said. "But you've all been telling me that the Iranians aren't playing by our rules." "Yes, but listen," Howell said fervently. "The straw I've been clinging to all through this is that we've done nothing wrong. And someday, somehow, somewhere, somebody is going to recognize that. And then all this will evaporate. I'd hate to give up that straw." "It hasn't got us far. Ross, I believe that with time and patience we will succeed. But if we get involved in bribery, we no longer have a case." Perot turned to Coburn. "How do we know Deep Throat has a deal wired with Dutgar?" "We don't know," Coburn said. "His argument is, we don't pay until we get results. So what do we have to lose?" "Everything," Howell said. "Never mind what is legal in the United States. This could seal our fate in Iran," Taylor said. "It stinks. The whole thing stinks." Perot was surprised by their reactions. He, too, hated the idea of bribery, but he was prepared to compromise his principles to get Paul and Bill out of jail. The good name of EDS was precious to him, and he was loath to let it be associated with corruption, just as John Howell was. But Perot knew something Howell did not know, that Colonel Simons and the rescue team faced risks more grave than this. Perot said, "Our good name hasn't done Paul and Bill any good so far." "It's not just our good name," Howell persisted. "Dutgar must be pretty sure by now that we aren't guilty of corruption. But if he could catch us in a bribe situation, he could still save face. That was a point, Perrault thought. Could this be a trap? Yes. It made sense. Unable to get any evidence against Paul and Bill, Dadgar pretends to Deep Throat that he can be bribed. Then, when Perrault falls for it, announces to the world that EDS is, after all, corrupt. Then they would all be put in jail with Paul and Bill. And being guilty, they would stay there. All right, said Perrault reluctantly. Call Deep Throat and tell him no thanks. Colburn stood up. Okay. It had been another fruitless day, Perrault thought. The Arrhenians had him all ways. Political pressure they ignored. Bribery could make matters worse. If EDS paid the bill, Paul and Bill would still be kept in Iran. Simons's team still looked like the best bet. But he was not going to tell the negotiating team that. All right, he said. We'll just try again tomorrow. Tall Keen Taylor and Short John Howell, like Batman and Robin, tried again on January 17th. They drove to the Ministry of Health building on Eisenhower Avenue, taking Albo Hassan as interpreter, and met Dadgar at 10 a.m. With Dadgar were officials of the Social Security Organization, the department of the ministry that was run by EDS's computers. Howell had decided to abandon his initial negotiating position, that EDS could not pay the bail because of American securities law. It was equally useless to demand to know the charges against Paul and Bill and what evidence there was. Dadgar could stonewall that approach by saying he was still investigating. But Howell did have a new strategy to replace the old. He was playing poker with no cards in his hand. Perhaps Dadgar would deal him some today. Dadgar began by explaining that the staff of the Social Security Organization wanted EDS to turn over to them what was known as the 125 Data Center. This small computer, Howell recalled, ran the payroll and pensions for the Social Security Organization staff. What these people wanted was to get their own wages, even while Iranians generally were not getting their Social Security benefits. King Taylor said, "It's not that simple. Such a turnover would be a very complex operation needing many skilled staff. Of course, they're all back in the States." Dadgar replied, "Then you should bring them back in." "I'm not that stupid," Taylor said. Taylor's Marine Corps sensitivity training was operating, Howell thought. Dadgar said, "If he speaks like this, he will go to jail." "Just as my staff would if I brought them back to Iran," said Taylor. Howell broke in, "Would you be able to give a legal guarantee that any returning staff would not be arrested or harassed in any way?" "I could not give a formal guarantee," Dadgar replied. "However, I would give my personal word of honor." Howell darted an anxious glance at Taylor. Taylor did not speak, but his expression said he would not give 2 cents for Dadgar's word of honor. "We could certainly investigate ways of arranging the turnover," Howell said. Dadgar had at last given him something to bargain with, even though it was not much. There would have to be safeguards, of course. For example, you would have to certify that the machinery was handed over to you in good condition, but perhaps we could employ independent experts to do that. Howell was shadowboxing. If the data center was handed over, there would be a price, the release of Paul and Bill. Dadgar demolished that idea with his next sentence. "Every day new complaints are being made about your company to my investigators, complaints that would justify increases in the bail. However, if you cooperate in the turnover of the 125 data center, I can in return ignore the new complaints and refrain from increasing the bail." Taylor said, "God damn it, this is nothing but blackmail." Howell realized that the 125 data center was a sideshow. Dadgar had raised the question, no doubt at the urging of these officials, but he did not care about it enough to offer serious concessions. So what did he care about? Howell thought of Lucio Randone, the former cellmate of Paul and Bill. Randone's offer of help had been followed up by EDS manager Paul Buca, who had gone to Italy to talk to Randone's company, Condotti d'Acqua. Buca reported that the company had been building apartment blocks in Tehran when their Iranian financiers ran out of money. The company naturally stopped building, but many Iranians had already paid for apartments under construction. Given the present atmosphere, it was not surprising that the foreigners got blamed, and Randone had been jailed as a scapegoat. The company had found a new source of finance and resumed building, and Randone had got out of jail at the same time in a package deal arranged by an Iranian lawyer, Ali Azmayesh. Buca also reported that the Italians kept saying, "Remember, Iran will always be Iran. It never changes." He took this to be a hint that a bribe was part of the package deal. Howell also knew that a traditional channel for paying a bribe was a lawyer's fee. The lawyer would do, say, $1,000 worth of work and pay a $10,000 bribe, then charge his client $11,000. This hint of corruption made Howell nervous, but despite that, he had gone to see Azmayesh, who had advised him, "EDS does not have a legal problem, it has a business problem." If EDS could come to a business arrangement with the Ministry of Health, Dadgar would go away. Azmayesh had not mentioned bribery. All this had started, Howell thought, as a business problem. The customer unable to pay, the supplier refusing to go on working. might a compromise be possible under which EDS would switch on the computers and the ministry would pay at least some money? He decided to ask that guard directly. Would it help if EDS were to renegotiate its contract with the Ministry of Health? This might be very helpful, Dedgar answered. It would not be a legal solution to our problem, but it might be a practical solution. Otherwise, to waste all the work that has been done in computerizing the ministry would be a pity. Interesting, thought Hal. They want a modern social security system or their money back. Putting Paul and Bill in jail on $13 million bail was their way of giving EDS those two options and no others. We're getting straight talk at last. He decided to be blunt. Of course, it would be out of the question to begin negotiations while Chaperone and Gaylord are still in jail. Dedgar replied, Still, if you commit to good faith negotiations, the ministry will call me and the charges might be changed. The bail might be reduced, and Chaperone and Gaylord might even be released on their personal guarantees. Nothing could be plainer than that, Hal thought. EDS had better go see the Minister of Health. Since the ministry stopped paying its bills, there had been two changes of government. Dr. Shekoles Lamizade, who was now in jail, had been replaced by a general. And then when Bakhtiar became prime minister, the general had in turn been replaced by a new minister of health. Who, Howell wondered, was the new guy, and what was he like?
Mr. Young of the American company EDS is calling you, minister, said the secretary.
Dr. Rasmarat took a deep breath.
Tell him that American businessmen may no longer pick up the phone and call ministers of the Iranian government and expect to talk to us as if we were their employees, he said.
He raised his voice.
Those days are over.
Then he asked for the EDS file. Manoher Rasmarat had been in Paris over Christmas. French-educated, he was a cardiologist, and married to a French woman, he considered France his second home and spoke fluent French. He was also a member of the Iranian National Medical Council and a friend of Shapur Bakhtiar. And when Bakhtiar had become prime minister, he had called his friend Rasmarat in Paris and asked him to come home to be minister of health. The EDS file was handed to him by Dr. Emrani, the deputy minister in charge of social security. Emrani had survived the two changes of government. He had been here when the trouble had started. Rasmarat read the file with mounting anger. The EDS project was insane. The basic contract price was $48 million, with escalators taking it up to a possible $90 million. Rasmarat recalled that Iran had 12,000 working doctors to serve a population of 32 million, and that there were 64,000 villages without tap water. And he concluded that whoever had signed the deal with EDS were fools or traitors or both. How could they possibly justify spending millions on computers when the people lacked the fundamental necessities of public health like clean water? There could only be one explanation. They had been bribed. Well, they would suffer. Emrani had prepared this dossier for the special court that prosecuted corrupt civil servants. Three people were in jail. Former minister Dr. Shekoles Lamizadeh and two of his deputy ministers, Reza Nagabat and Nili Arame. That was as it should be. The blame for the mess they were in should fall primarily on Iranians. However, the Americans were also culpable. American businessmen and their government had encouraged the Shah in his mad schemes and had taken their profits. Now they must suffer. Furthermore, according to the file, EDS had been spectacularly incompetent. The computers were not yet working. After 2.5 years, yet the automation project had so disrupted Emrani's department that the old-fashioned systems were not working either, with the result that Emrani could not monitor his department's expenditure. This was a principal cause of the ministry's overspending its budget, the file said. Rasmarat noted that the U.S. Embassy was protesting about the jailing of the two Americans, Chaperone and Gaylord, because there was no evidence against them. That was typical of the Americans. Of course there was no proof. Bribes were not paid by check. The embassy was also concerned for the safety of the two prisoners. Rasmarat found this ironic. He was concerned for his safety. Each day when he went to the office, he wondered whether he would come home alive. He closed the file. He had no sympathy for EDS or its jailed executives. Even if he had wanted to have them released, he would not have been able to, he reflected. The anti-American mood of the people was rising to fever pitch. The government of which Rasmarat was a part, the Bakhtiar regime, had been installed by the Shah and was therefore widely suspected of being pro-American. With the country in such turmoil, any minister who concerned himself with the welfare of a couple of greedy American capitalist lackeys would be sacked, if not lynched, and quite rightly. Rasmarat turned his attention to more important matters. The next day, his secretary said, Mr. Young of the American company EDS is here asking to see you, minister. The arrogance of the Americans was infuriating, Rasmarat said. Repeat to him the message I gave you yesterday. Then give him 5 minutes to get off the premises.
For Bill, the big problem was time. He was different from Paul. For Paul, restless, aggressive, strong-willed, ambitious, the worst of being in jail was the helplessness. Bill was more placid by nature. He accepted that there was nothing to do but pray. So he prayed. He did not wear his religion on his sleeve. He did his praying late at night, before going to sleep, or early in the morning before the others woke up. What got to Bill was the excruciating slowness with which time passed. A day in the real world, a day of solving problems, making decisions, taking phone calls and attending meetings, was no time at all. A day in jail was endless. Bill devised a formula for conversion of real time to jail time. 1 second in real time equaled 1 minute jail time. 1 minute real time equaled 1 hour jail time. 1 hour real time equaled 1 day jail time. 1 week real time equaled 1 month jail time. 1 month real time equaled 1 year jail time. Time took on this new dimension for Bill after 2 or 3 weeks in jail, when he realized there was going to be no quick solution to the problem. Unlike a convicted criminal, he had not been sentenced to 90 days or 5 years, so he could gain no comfort from scratching a calendar on the wall as a countdown to freedom. It made no difference how many days had passed. His remaining time in jail was indefinite, therefore endless. His Persian cellmates did not seem to feel this way. It was a revealing cultural contrast. The Americans, trained to get fast results, were tortured by suspense. The Iranians were content to wait for Farda. Tomorrow, next week, sometime, eventually, just as they had been in business. Nevertheless, as the Shah's grip weakened, Bill thought he saw signs of desperation in some of them, and he came to mistrust them. He was careful not to tell them who was in town from Dallas, or what progress was being made in the negotiations for his release. He was afraid that, clutching at straws, they would have tried to trade information to the guards. He was becoming a well-adjusted jailbird. He learned to ignore dirt and bugs, and he got used to cold, starchy, unappetizing food. He learned to live within a small, clearly defined personal boundary, the prisoner's turf. He stayed active. He found ways to fill the endless days. He read books, taught Paul chess, exercised in the hall, talked to the Iranians to get every word of the radio and TV news, and prayed. He made a minutely detailed survey of the jail, measuring the cells and the corridors and drawing plans and sketches. He kept a diary, recording every trivial event of jail life, plus everything his visitors told him and all the news. He used initials instead of names, and sometimes put in invented incidents or altered versions of real incidents, so that if the diary were confiscated or read by the authorities, it would confuse them. Like prisoners everywhere, he looked forward to visitors as eagerly as a child waiting for Christmas. The EDS people brought decent food, warm clothing, new books, and letters from home. One day, Keen Taylor brought a picture of Bill's 6-year-old son, Christopher, standing in front of the Christmas tree. Seeing his little boy, even in a photograph, gave Bill strength, a powerful reminder of what he had to hope for. It renewed his resolve to hang on and not despair. Bill wrote letters to Emily and gave them to Keen, who would read them to her over the phone. Bill had known Keen for 10 years, and they were quite close. They had lived together after the evacuation. Bill knew that Keen was not as insensitive as his reputation would indicate. Half of that was an act. But still, it was embarrassing to write, "I love you," knowing that Keen would be reading it. Bill got over the embarrassment because he wanted very badly to tell Emily and the children how much he loved them, just in case he never got another chance to say it in person. The letters were like those written by pilots on the eve of a dangerous mission. The most important gift brought by the visitors was news. The all-too-brief meetings in the low building across the courtyard were spent discussing the various efforts being made to get Paul and Bill out. It seemed to Bill that time was the key factor. Sooner or later, one approach or another had to work. Unfortunately, as time passed, Iran went downhill. The forces of the revolution were gaining momentum. Would EDS get Paul and Bill out before the whole country exploded? It was increasingly dangerous for the EDS people to come to the south of the city where the jail was. Paul and Bill never knew when the next visit would come, or whether there would be a next visit. As 4 days went by, then 5, Bill would wonder whether all the others had gone back to the United States and left him and Paul behind. Considering that the bail was impossibly high and the streets of Tehran impossibly dangerous, might they all give up Paul and Bill as a lost cause? They might be forced, against their wills, to leave in order to save their own lives. Bill recalled the American withdrawal from Vietnam, with the last embassy officials being lifted off the roofs by helicopter, and he could imagine the scene repeated at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. He was occasionally reassured by a visit from an embassy official. They, too, were taking a risk in coming, but they never brought any hard news about government efforts to help Paul and Bill came to the conclusion that the State Department was inept. Visits from Dr. Houman, their Iranian attorney, were at first highly encouraging, but then Bill realized that, in typically Iranian fashion, Houman was promising much and producing little. The fiasco of the meeting with Dadgar was desperately depressing. It was frightening to see how easily Dadgar outmaneuvered Houman, and how determined Dadgar was to keep Paul and Bill jailed. Bill had not slept that night. When he thought about the bail, he found it staggering. No one had ever paid that much ransom anywhere in the world. He recalled news stories about American businessmen kidnapped in South America and held for $1 million or $2 million. They were usually killed. Other kidnappings of millionaires, politicians, and celebrities had involved demands for $3 or $4 million, never 13. No one would pay that much for Paul and Bill. Besides, even that much money would not buy them the right to leave the country. They would probably be kept under house arrest in Tehran while the mobs took over. Bail sometimes seemed more like a trap than a way of escape. It was a catch-22. The whole experience was a lesson in values. Bill learned that he could do without his fine house, his cars, fancy food, and clean clothes. It was no big deal to be living in a dirty room with bugs crawling across the walls. Everything he had in life had been stripped away, and he discovered that the only thing he cared about was his family. When you got right down to it, that was all that really counted. Emily, Vicky, Jackie, Jenny, and Chris. Coburn's visit had cheered him a little. Seeing Jay in that big down coat and woolen hat with a growth of red beard on his chin, Bill had guessed that he was not in Tehran to work through legal channels. Coburn had spent most of the visit with Paul, and if Paul had learned more, he had not passed it on to Bill. Bill was content. He would find out as soon as he needed to know. But the day after Coburn's visit, there was bad news. On January 16th, the Shah left Iran. The television set in the hall of the jail was switched on, exceptionally, in the afternoon, and Paul and Bill, with all the other prisoners, watched the little ceremony in the Imperial Pavilion at Mehrabad Airport. There was the Shah with his wife, three of his four children, his mother-in-law, and a crowd of courtiers. There to see them off was Prime Minister Shapur Bakhtiar and a crowd of generals. Bakhtiar kissed the Shah's hand, and the royal party went out to the airplane. The ministry people in the jail were gloomy. Most of them had been friends, of one kind or another, with the royal family or its immediate circle. Now their patrons were leaving. It meant, at the very least, that they had to resign themselves to a long stay in jail. Bill felt that the Shah had taken with him the last chance of a pro-American outcome in Iran. Now there would be more chaos and confusion, more danger to all Americans in Tehran, and less chance of a swift release for Paul and Bill. Soon after the television showed the Shah's jet rising into the sky, Bill began to hear a background noise, like a distant crowd, from outside the jail. The noise quickly grew to a pandemonium of shouting and cheering and hooting of horns. The TV showed the source of the noise. A crowd of hundreds of thousands of Iranians were surging through the streets yelling, "Shah, Raft!" The Shah has gone. Paul said it reminded him of the New Year's Day parade in Philadelphia. All cars were driving with their headlights on, and most were hooting continuously. Many drivers pulled their windshield wipers forward, attached rags to them, and turned them on so that they swayed from side to side, permanent mechanical flag wavers. Truckloads of jubilant youths careened around the streets celebrating, and all over the city crowds were pulling down and smashing statues of the Shah. Bill wondered what the mobs would do next. This led him to wonder what the guards and the other prisoners would do next. In the hysterical release of all this pent-up Iranian emotion, would Americans become targets? He and Paul stayed in their cell for the rest of the day, trying to be inconspicuous. They lay on their bunks, talking desultorily. Paul smoked. Bill tried not to think about the terrifying scenes he had watched on TV, but the roar of that lawless multitude, the collective shout of revolutionary triumph, penetrated the prison walls and filled his ears like the deafening crack and roll of nearby thunder a moment before the lightning strikes. 2 days later, on the morning of January 18th, a guard came to cell number 5 and said something in Farsi to Reza Nehabat, the former deputy minister. Nehabat translated to Paul and Bill, "You must get your things together. They are moving you." "Where to?" Paul asked. "To another jail." Alarm bells rang in Bill's mind. What kind of jail were they going to? The kind where people were tortured and killed? Would EDS be told where they had gone, or would the two of them simply disappear? This place was not wonderful, but it was the devil they knew. The guard spoke again, and Nehabat said, "He tells you not to be concerned. This is for your own good." It was the work of minutes to put together their toothbrushes, their shared shaver, and their few spare clothes. Then they sat and waited for 3 hours. It was unnerving. Bill had got used to this jail, and despite his occasional paranoia, basically he trusted his cellmates. He feared the change would be for the worse. Paul asked Nehabat to try to get news of the move to EDS, maybe by bribing the colonel in charge of the jail. The cell father, the old man who had been so concerned for their welfare, was upset that they were leaving. He watched sadly as Paul took down the pictures of Karen and Anne-Marie. Impulsively, Paul gave the photographs to the old man, who was visibly moved and thanked him profusely. At last they were taken out into the courtyard and herded onto a minibus, along with half a dozen other prisoners from different parts of the jail. Bill looked around at the others, trying to figure out what they had in common. One was a Frenchman. Were all the foreigners being taken to a jail of their own for their safety? But another was the burly Iranian who had been boss of the downstairs cell where they had spent their first night, a common criminal, Bill assumed. As the bus pulled out of the courtyard, Bill spoke to the Frenchman. "Do you know where we're going?" "I am to be released," the Frenchman said. Bill's heart leaped. This was good news. Perhaps they were all to be released. He turned his attention to the scene in the streets. It was the first time for 3 weeks he had seen the outside world. The government buildings all around the Ministry of Justice were damaged. The mobs really had run wild. Burned cars and broken windows were everywhere. The streets were full of soldiers and tanks. But they were doing nothing, not maintaining order, not even controlling the traffic. It seemed to Bill only a matter of time before the weak Bakhtiar government would be overthrown. What had happened to the EDS people, Taylor, Powell, Young, Gallagher, and Coburn? They had not appeared at the jail since the Shah left. Had they been forced to flee to save their own lives? Somehow Bill was sure they were still in town, still trying to get him and Paul out of jail. He began to hope that this transfer had been arranged by them. Perhaps instead of taking the prisoners to a different jail, the bus would divert and take them to the U.S. airbase. The more he thought about it, the more he believed that everything had been arranged for their release. No doubt the American embassy had realized, since the departure of the Shah, that Paul and Bill were in serious danger and had at last got on the case with some real diplomatic muscle. The bus ride was a ruse, a cover story to get them out of the Ministry of Justice jail without arousing the suspicion of hostile Iranian officials, such as Dadgar. The bus was heading north. It passed through districts with which Bill was familiar, and he began to feel safer as the turbulent south of the city receded behind him. Also, the airbase was to the north. The bus entered a wide square dominated by a huge structure like a fortress. Bill looked interestedly at the building. Its walls were about 25 feet high and dotted with guard towers and machine gun emplacements. The square was full of Iranian women in chadors, the traditional black robes, all making a heck of a noise. Was this some kind of palace or mosque, or perhaps a military base? The bus approached the fortress and slowed down. Oh no. A pair of huge steel doors were set centrally in the front. To Bill's horror, the bus drove up and stopped with its nose to the gateway. This awesome place was the new prison, the new nightmare. The gates opened, and the bus entered. They were not going to the airbase. EDS had not arranged a deal. The embassy had not got moving. They were not going to be released. The bus stopped again. The steel doors closed behind it, and a second pair of doors opened in front. The bus passed through and stopped in a massive compound dotted with buildings. A guard said something in Farsi, and all the prisoners stood up to get off the bus. Bill felt like a disappointed child. Life is rotten, he thought. What did I do to deserve this? What did I do?
"Don't drive so fast," said Simons. Joe Pache said, "Do I drive unsafe?" "No, I just don't want you violating the laws." "What laws?" "Just be careful." Coburn interrupted. "We're there." Pache stopped the car. They all looked across the heads of the weird women in black and saw the vast fortress of the Gasa prison. "Jesus Christ," said Simons. His deep, rough voice was tinged with awe. "Just look at that bastard." They all stared at the high walls, the enormous gates, the guard towers, and the machine gun nests. Simons said, "That place is worse than the Alamo." It dawned on Coburn that their little rescue team could not attack this place, not without the help of the entire U.S. Army. The rescue they had planned so carefully and rehearsed so many times was now completely irrelevant. There would be no modifications or improvements to the plan, no new scenarios. The whole idea was dead. They sat in the car for a while, each with his own thoughts. "Who are those women?" Coburn wondered aloud. "They have relatives in the jail," Pache explained. Coburn could hear a peculiar noise. "Listen," he said. "What is that?" "The women," said Pache, "wailing." Colonel Simons had looked up at an impregnable fortress once before. He had been Captain Simons then, and his friends had called him Art, not Bull. It was October 1944. Art Simons, 26 years old, was commander of Company B, 6th Ranger Infantry Battalion. The Americans were winning the war in the Pacific and were about to attack the Philippine Islands. Ahead of the invading U.S. forces, the 6th Rangers were already there, committing sabotage and mayhem behind enemy lines. Company B landed on Homenhon Island in the Leyte Gulf and found there were no Japanese on the island. Simons raised the stars and stripes on a coconut palm in front of 200 docile natives. That day, a report came in that the Japanese garrison on nearby Suluan Island was massacring civilians. Simons requested permission to take Suluan. Permission was refused. A few days later, he asked again. He was told that no ships could be spared to transport Company B across the water. Simons asked permission to use native transportation. This time he got the okay. Simons commandeered 3 native sailboats and 11 canoes and appointed himself admiral of the fleet. He sailed at 2 a.m. with 80 men. A storm blew up, 7 of the canoes capsized, and Simons' fleet returned to shore with most of the navy swimming. They set off again the next day. This time they sailed by daylight, and since Japanese planes still controlled the air, the men stripped off and concealed their uniforms and equipment in the bottoms of the boat so that they would look like native fishermen. The ruse worked, and Company B made landfall on Suluan Island. Simons immediately reconnoitered the Japanese garrison. That was when he looked up at an impregnable fortress. The Japanese were garrisoned at the south end of the island in a lighthouse at the top of a 300-foot coral cliff. On the west side, a trail led halfway up the cliff to a steep flight of steps cut into the coral. The entire stairway and most of the trail were in full view of the 60-foot lighthouse tower and 3 west-facing buildings on the lighthouse platform. It was a perfect defensive position. 2 men could have held off 500 on that flight of coral steps. But there was always a way. Simons decided to attack from the east by scaling the cliff. The assault began at 1 a.m. on November 2nd. Simons and 14 men crouched at the foot of the cliff directly below the garrison. Their faces and hands were blacked. There was a bright moon, and the terrain was as open as an Iowa prairie. For silence, they communicated by hand signals and wore their socks over their boots. Simons gave the signal, and they began to climb. The sharp edges of the coral sliced into the flesh of their fingers and the palms of their hands. In places, there were no footholds, and they had to go up climbing vines, hand over hand. They were completely vulnerable. If one curious sentry should look over the platform down the east side of the cliff, he would see them instantly and could pick them off one by one, easy shooting. They were halfway up when the silence was rent by a deafening clang. Someone's rifle stock had banged against a coral cone. They all stopped and lay still against the face of the cliff. Simons held his breath and waited for the rifle shot from above that would begin the massacre. It never came. After 10 minutes, they went on. The climb took a full hour. Simons was first over the top. He crouched on the platform, feeling naked in the bright moonlight. No Japanese were visible, but he could hear voices from one of the low buildings. He trained his rifle on the lighthouse. The rest of the men began to reach the platform. The attack was to start as soon as they got the machine gun set up. Just as the gun came over the edge of the cliff, a sleepy Japanese soldier wandered into view heading for the latrine. Simons signaled to his point guard, who shot the Japanese, and the firefight began. Simons turned immediately to the machine gun. He held one leg in the ammunition box, while the gunner held down the other leg and fired. The astonished Japanese ran out of the building straight into the deadly hail of bullets. 20 minutes later, it was over. Some 15 of the enemy had been killed. Simons' squad suffered 2 casualties, neither fatal, and the impregnable fortress had been taken. There was always a way.
Chapter 7. The American Embassy's Volkswagen minibus threaded its way through the streets of Tehran, heading for Ghazar Square. Ross Perot sat inside. It was January 19th, the day after Paul and Bill were moved, and Perot was going to visit them in the new jail. It was a little crazy. Everyone had gone to great lengths to hide Perot in Tehran, for fear that Dadgar, seeing a far more valuable hostage than Paul or Bill, would arrest him and throw him in jail. Yet here he was, heading for the jail of his own free will, with his own passport in his pocket for identification. His hopes were pinned on the notorious inability of government everywhere to let its right hand know what its left was doing. The Ministry of Justice might want to arrest him, but it was the military who ran the jails, and the military had no interest in him. Nevertheless, he was taking precautions. He would go in with a group of people. Rich Gallagher and Jay Coburn were on the bus, as well as some embassy people who were going to visit an American woman in the jail. And he was wearing casual clothes and carrying a cardboard box containing groceries, books, and warm clothing for Paul and Bill. Nobody at the prison would know his face. He would have to give his name as he went in, but why would a minor clerk or prison guard recognize it? His name might be on a list at the airport, at police stations, or at hotels, but the prison would surely be the last place that guard would expect him to turn up. Anyway, he was determined to take the risk. He wanted to boost Paul's and Bill's morale, and to show them that he was willing to stick out his neck for them. It would be the only achievement of his trip. His efforts to get the negotiations moving had come to nothing. The bus entered Ghazar Square, and he got his first sight of the new prison. It was formidable. He could not imagine how Simons and his little rescue team could possibly break in there. In the square were scores of people, mostly women in chadors, making a lot of noise. The bus stopped near the huge steel doors. Perrault wondered about the bus driver. He was Iranian, and he knew who Perrault was. They all got out. Perrault saw a television camera near the prison entrance. His heart missed a beat. It was an American crew. What the hell were they doing there? He kept his head down as he pushed his way through the crowd, carrying his cardboard box. A guard looked out of a small window set into the brick wall beside the gates. The television crew seemed to be taking no notice of him. A minute later, a little door in one of the gates swung open, and the visitors stepped inside. The door clanged shut behind them. Perrault had passed the point of no return. He walked on, through a second pair of steel doors, into the prison compound. It was a big place, with streets between the buildings and chickens and turkeys running around loose. He followed the others through a doorway into a reception room. He showed his passport. The clerk pointed to a register. Perrault took out his pen and signed H.R. Perrault, more or less legibly. The clerk handed back the passport and waved him on. He had been right. Nobody here had heard of Ross Perrault. He walked on into a waiting room and stopped dead. Standing there, talking to an Iranian in general's uniform, was someone who knew perfectly well who Ross Perrault was. It was Ramsey Clark, a Texan who had been U.S. Attorney General under President Lyndon B. Johnson. Perrault had met him several times and knew Clark's sister, Mimi, very well. For a moment, Perrault froze. That explains the television cameras, he thought. He wondered whether he could keep out of Clark's sight. Any moment now, he thought, Ramsey will see me and say to the general, Lord, there's Ross Perrault of VDS. And if I look as if I'm trying to hide, it will be even worse. He made a snap decision. He walked over to Clark, stuck out his hand, and said, Hello, Ramsey. What are you doing in jail? Clark looked down. He was 6'3", and laughed. They shook hands. How's Mimi? Perrault asked before Clark had a chance to perform introductions. The general was saying something in Farsi to an underling. Clark said, Mimi's fine. Well, good to see you, Perrault said, and walked on. His mouth was dry as he went out of the waiting room and into the prison compound with Gallagher, Coburn, and the embassy people. That had been a close shave. An Iranian in colonel's uniform joined them. He had been assigned to take care of them, Gallagher said. Perrault wondered what Clark was saying to the general now.
Paul was sick. The cold he had caught in the first jail had recurred. He was coughing persistently and had pains in his chest. He could not get warm in this jail or in the old one. For 3 whole weeks, he had been cold. He had asked his EDS visitors to get him warm underwear, but for some reason they had not brought any. He was also miserable. He really had expected that Coburn and the rescue team would ambush the bus that brought him and Bill here from the Ministry of Justice, and when the bus had entered the impregnable Gasser prison, he had been bitterly disappointed. General Muhari, who ran the prison, had explained to Paul and Bill that he was in charge of all the jails in Tehran, and he had arranged for their transfer to this one for their own safety. It was small consolation. Being less vulnerable to the mobs, this place was also more difficult, if not impossible, for the rescue team to attack. The Gasser prison was part of a large military complex. On its west side was the old Gasser Ghazar Palace, which had been turned into a police academy by the Shah's father. The prison compound had once been the palace gardens. To the north was a military hospital. To the east, an army camp where helicopters took off and landed all day. The compound itself was bounded by an inner wall 25 or 30 feet high and an outer wall 12 feet high. Inside were 15 or 20 separate buildings, including a bakery, a mosque, and 6 cell blocks, one reserved for women. Paul and Bill were in building number 8. It was a 2-story block in a courtyard surrounded by a fence of tall iron bars covered with chicken wire. The environment was not bad for a jail. There was a fountain in the middle of the courtyard, rose bushes around the sides, and 10 or 15 pine trees. The prisoners were allowed outside during the day and could play volleyball or ping pong in the courtyard. However, they could not pass through the courtyard gate, which was manned by a guard. The ground floor of the building was a small hospital with 20 or so patients, mostly mental cases. They screamed a lot. Paul and Bill and a handful of other prisoners were on the first floor. They had a large cell, about 20 feet by 30, which they shared with only one other prisoner, an Iranian lawyer in his 50s who spoke English and French as well as Farsi. He had showed them pictures of his villa in France. There was a TV set in the cell. Meals were prepared by some of the prisoners, who were paid for this by the others, and eaten in a separate dining room. The food here was better than at the first jail. Extra privileges could be bought, and one of the other inmates, apparently a hugely wealthy man, had a private room, and meals brought in from outside. The routine was relaxed. There were no set times for getting up and going to bed. For all that, Paul was thoroughly depressed. A measure of extra comfort meant little. What he wanted was freedom. He was not much cheered when they were told on the morning of January 19th that they had visitors. There was a visiting room on the ground floor of building number 8, but today, without explanation, they were taken out of the building and along the street. Paul realized they were headed for a building known as the Officers' Club, set in a small tropical garden with ducks and peacocks. As they approached the place, he glanced around the compound and saw his visitors coming in the opposite direction. He could not believe his eyes. "My God," he said delightedly, "it's Ross." Forgetting where he was, he turned to run over to Perrault. The guard jerked him back. "Can you believe this?" he said to Bill. "Perrault's here." The guard hustled him through the garden. Paul kept looking back at Perrault, wondering whether his eyes were deceiving him. He was led into a big circular room with banqueting tables around the outside and walls covered with small triangles of mirrored glass. It was like a small ballroom. A moment later, Perrault came in with Gallagher, Coburn, and several other people. Perrault was grinning broadly. Paul shook his hand, then embraced him. It was an emotional moment. Paul felt the way he did when he listened to the Star-Spangled Banner. A kind of shiver went up and down his spine. He was loved. He was cared for. He had friends. He belonged. Perrault had come halfway across the world into the middle of a revolution just to visit him. Perrault and Bill embraced and shook hands. Bill said, "Ross, what in the world are you doing here? Have you come to take us home?" "Not quite," Perrault said. "Not yet." The guards gathered at the far end of the room to drink tea. The embassy staff who had come in with Perrault sat around another table, talking to a woman prisoner. Perrault put his box on a table. "There's some long underwear in here for you," he said to Paul. "We couldn't buy any, so this is mine, and I want it back, you hear?" "Sure," Paul grinned. "We brought you some books as well, and groceries. Peanut butter and tuna fish and juice and I don't know what." He took a stack of envelopes from his pocket. "And your mail." Paul glanced at his. There was a letter from Ruthie. Another envelope was addressed to Chapanoodle. Paul smiled. That would be from his friend David Bain, whose son Tommy, unable to pronounce chaperone, had dubbed Paul Chapanoodle. He pocketed the letters to read later and said, "How's Ruthie?" "She's just fine. I talked her on the phone," Perrault said. "Now, we have assigned one man to each of your wives to make sure everything necessary is done to take care of them. Ruthie's in Dallas now, Paul, staying with Jim and Kathy Neifeller. She's buying a house, and Tom Walter is handling all the legal details for her." He turned to Bill. "Emily has gone to visit her sister Vicky in North Carolina. She needed a break. She's been working with Tim Reardon in Washington, putting pressure on the State Department. She wrote to Rosalind Carter, you know, as one wife to another. She's trying everything. Matter of fact, we're all trying everything." As Perrault ran down the long list of people who had been asked to help, from Texas congressmen all the way up to Henry Kissinger, Bill realized that the main purpose of Perrault's visit was to boost his and Paul's morale. It was something of an anticlimax. For a moment back there, when he had seen Perrault walking across the compound with the other guys, grinning all over his face, Bill had thought, here comes the rescue party. At last they've got this damn thing solved, and Perrault is coming to tell us personally. He was disappointed. But he cheered up as Perrault talked. With his letters from home and his box of goodies, Perrault was like Santa Claus, and his presence here and the big grin on his face symbolized a tremendous defiance of Dadgar, the mobs, and everything that threatened them. Bill was worried now about Emily's morale. He knew instinctively what was going on in his wife's mind. The fact that she had gone to North Carolina told him she had given up hope. It had become too much for her to keep up a facade of normality with the children at her parents' house. He knew somehow that she had started smoking again. That would puzzle little Chris. Emily had given up smoking when she went into the hospital to have her gallbladder removed, and she had told Chris then that she had had her smoker taken out. Now he would wonder how it had got back in. "If all this fails," Perrault was saying, "we have another team in town who will get you out of here by other methods. You'll recognize all the members of the team except one, the leader, an older man." Paul said, "I have a problem with that, Ross. Why should a bunch of guys get cut up for the sake of two?" Bill wondered just what was being planned. Would a helicopter fly over the compound and pick them up? Would the U.S. Army storm the walls? It was hard to imagine, but with Perrault, anything could happen. Coburn said to Paul, "I want you to observe and memorize all the details you can about the compound and the prison routine, just like before." Bill was feeling embarrassed about his mustache. He had grown it to make him look more Iranian. EDS executives were not allowed to have mustaches or beards, but he had not expected to see Perrault. It was silly, he knew, but he felt uncomfortable about it. "I apologize for this," he said, touching his upper lip. "I'm trying to be inconspicuous. I'll shave it off as soon as I get out of here." "Keep it," Perrault said with a smile. "Let Emily and the children see it. Anyway, we're going to change the dress code. We've had the results of the employee attitude survey and we'll probably permit mustaches and colored shirts, too." Bill looked at Coburn. "And beards?" No beards. Coburn has a very special excuse. The guards came to break up the party. Visiting time was over. Perot said, "We don't know whether we'll get you out quickly or slowly. Tell yourselves it will be slowly. If you get up each morning thinking today could be the day, you may have a lot of disappointments and become demoralized. Prepare yourselves for a long stay, and you may be pleasantly surprised. But always remember this, we will get you out." They all shook hands. Paul said, "I really don't know how to thank you for coming, Ross." Perot smiled. "Just don't leave without my underwear." They all walked out of the building. The EDS men headed across the compound toward the prison gate, leaving Paul and Bill and their guards watching. As his friends disappeared, Bill was seized by a longing just to go with them. Not today, he told himself. Not today.
Perot wondered whether he would be allowed to leave. Ramsey Clark had a full hour to let the cat out of the bag. What had he said to the general? Would there be a reception committee waiting in the administration block at the prison entrance? His heart beat faster as he entered the waiting room. There was no sign of the general or of Clark. He walked through and into the reception area. Nobody looked at him. With Coburn and Gallagher close behind, he walked through the first set of doors. Nobody stopped him. He was going to get away with it. He crossed the little courtyard and waited by the big gate. The small door set into one of the gates was opened. Perot walked out of the prison. The TV cameras were still there. "All I need," he thought, "having gotten this far, is to have the U.S. network show my picture." He pushed his way through the crowd to the embassy minibus and climbed aboard. Coburn and Gallagher got on with him,